number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
Welcome to The Stuart Knight Show, where interesting, intriguing, and exciting people engage in unscripted exchanges of ideas, stories, and perspectives. It's not an interview. It's a powerful conversation.
Hey there, everybody. Stuart Knight here with my friend Phil Levy in Brazil. We like to call him Phil in Brazil. Phil, how is it going, my friend?
Very good, Stuart. Very good.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you can make it onto the show today. This is kind of interesting for those of you who are listening right now. Phil is an individual who is not only a friend, but he's also a big listener of the podcast. And we were kind of joking around how he's gone from listener to participant. So thanks for being on the show today.
Yeah, well, it's an honor.
Well, I think it's going to be cool. You and I always have great conversations, and I'm always interested in where it goes. And for those of you who are listening for the first time, I never have any agenda. It really is just whatever comes to mind, and then we just let the conversation organically go from there. The idea is for you to hopefully be inspired by what can happen when people do ask each other good questions and when they do allow themselves to get into topics that go above and beyond the friggin' weather, you know? So by the way, Phil, I wanted to tell you, there is a documentary, and for anyone listening, you've got to watch this. I saw it last night, and I think you'll be really, we're always sharing documentaries with each other. Mm-hmm. The one that I really like is, that I just saw is called Sirius, and it's S-I-R-I-U-S. And this is, I mean, I've always been really intrigued by what's happening in outer space. And it's always amazing to me that more people don't look up in their, into the sky and go, oh my God, like, look at that thing. You know, it's like sometimes yeah. I'm driving, I'm not sure if I've said this to you before, but sometimes I'm driving my car down the street and I'll think to myself, oh my God, I'm driving a car in outer space.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so this documentary talks about, you know, the idea of extraterrestrial life and, you know, UFO sightings. And when it comes right down to it now, it's like, and I've always said this too, we've had way too many encounters for at least one of them to not have been, you know, more than a guy on mushrooms. Right? Like we've I think, you know, it's like the crop circles, whatever it is. Like there's been 3,500 identified crop circles. And whenever you see them from the sky, these crop circles are always, you know, perfectly formed. I mean, and people say, yeah, it'd be kind of impossible for an individual to, you know, do that in one night and without being seen. I mean, the kind of lighting structure, by the way, that you'd need in order to do that would be, you know, would draw some attention. And people say, well, you know what, some farmers are probably just doing it for a joke. I'm like, you know what, maybe some farmers are, but for 3,500, you don't need all of them to be right. You just need one of them to be right.
Well, and it's a lot of work. Why hasn't anyone come out and just been proud of it to say, yeah, I did that? I mean, you know, it's hard enough to get someone to help you move house, never mind come out to a huge farm and start making massive crop circles, and then no one talks about it, you know?
That's a good point, right? Yeah, it's like, can you help me move? It's like, oh, man, I totally put my back out. Can you imagine you say to somebody, oh, yeah, listen, would you be open to the idea of building a crop circle that is about, yeah, you know, 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer, and it's just, I think it should probably only take us about, you know, a month.
No, it's a huge project. I mean, and I think, you know, it's funny because it's amazing. I always find, I don't know if it's law of attraction, but I've just been on the same kind of vibe as you, where I've just realized we've kind of lost. And again, I guess, I don't know, it goes, I got my opinions on where we lost it. And I think it starts in the school system, but we lost our sense of wonder.
Yeah.
Like what happened to that? Like what happens to us that we get into this thing where everything now, like we need we're given an answer, like the crop circles. Okay, this is how it happened, and how a majority of the population just leave it. Yeah, it's probably a hoax, and they leave it.
Mm-hmm.
But what if it isn't?
Right.
I mean, you know, shouldn't we just look at it and, like, I mean, and if it is true, isn't that saying something about us that people come here to visit and they don't want to stay?
You're right.
I mean, you know, they've traveled from God knows where.
Right.
And they've looked at it and said, I don't know. It's not a place to vacation with the family. I mean, people are like,
it's like Cancun. It's like, you know, well, you go there once, you don't really want to go back.
No, but I mean, you got to imagine, if you were to look at it from the perspective of people visiting our planet, if it's true, you've got, if you step back and look, that you've got, you know, parts of the land where the people are overweight, and then the other part where people have no food. You've got people just in war, killing each other, you know, doing all sorts of crazy stuff with the planet, destroying the planet they live on. Surely that's not a place that anyone's interested in visiting.
Yeah,
for too long.
Well, it's funny because when you say that, to me, that sounds like Thanksgiving. It's like you got the one fat person at the end of the table, the other thin person at the other end of the table. Everyone's having fights across the table.
Yeah.
No, I know what you're saying. It is, you know, that. But once again, like, that to me is an interesting conversation. Like, if somebody is visiting us, why are they not staying? Now, in this particular documentary, what was really interesting is that they're kind of pontificating the whole idea that, you know, whether you look at the superpowers of the world, okay, so the four big banks of America are in control of or have ownership of the four big oil cartels in the world. And we all know that we live in a world where major, major corporations are doing every single thing that they possibly can in order to control money and to be able to make it so that nobody has anything close to what they have. It's actually, you know, many psychologists would consider it psychotic behavior. Right. Whereas the latest stat that I just saw in this documentary was that 1% of the population of the United States owns 40% of the wealth, and 80% of the population of the United States owns 7% of the wealth. And so the idea that this documentary was talking about was that if we were to be contacted or to allow ourselves to learn from these beings from other planets, that we would learn about, you know, for example, new forms of energy, and energy that would make it so that we would absolutely have no need for oil or fossil fuels, which of course wouldn't go so well for the 1% that own 40% of the wealth. And so what you do is if you own the government, and of course most major corporations do, everyone thinks that, you know, Barack Obama runs the United States. He does not run the United States. The Shell runs the United States. And if you can make it so that you get the government to stop people from even acknowledging or even considering the idea that there could be life forms out there, or considering the idea that there could be other forms of energy that we could use, then you get to keep on controlling the system. So that really is what this documentary is talking about. And I've seen this in many documentaries. We continuously, our sense of wonder is quashed. And I think you're right. It does happen in the school system. You know, guidance counselors will say, oh, you know what, I know you've got this sense of wonder of becoming a doctor or a lawyer or a scientist or whatever, a playwright. And you know what, just go for something more practical. Become an electrician. And I think we just really do have our sense of wonder just gets quashed. So when our government says, oh, I know you may have thought you've seen a UFO in the sky, but come on now, just let that go. And we've been conditioned since the age of five to let these ideas go. So why wouldn't we do it when we're 45 or 55?
Well, if you just got to, again, it's all about asking the right questions. So when you look at the school system, for me, and I was just talking about this the other day with my dad, funny enough, you know, name an author of a textbook.
Right. Oh, yeah.
I mean, who wrote the stuff, right, that we learn from? And what was the purpose of that? No one asked that. And if you really look at it, the whole school system has just been built by one company, which we can call Money Inc.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So when you go into school, this is not about ideas. It's not about challenging the students. It's about, okay, this is how you work for Money Inc., right?
Yeah.
And now Money Inc. is sitting at the top, and then there's all these types of companies and professions and all that below it. And so it's where you fit into that system. It has absolutely nothing to do with us growing as the human race. That has just been, you know, that's been like, don't think about that.
Yeah, that's
secondary.
What
you need to do. You know, that's not even a topic, you know?
Yeah, I know. Isn't that funny to think that people, you know, the idea of progressing and becoming better is actually secondary to making sure that the system works?
Well, what's our objective as the human race? Like, if you just stop and just say, okay, like, you know, what agitates me the most is just see a lot of people, and I just thought about it today, like, today's Friday, you know? The one thing that irritates me the most, people like, thank God it's Friday.
Right.
I mean, really?
Yeah.
Is that what we've come to, that we enjoy 2 days of our week? Like, our whole life is now, like, you know, it's separated. You got the 5 days, which are just garbage, and then you have your 2 days, which you need to panic and get everything done.
You know? I just heard the other day this great quote. It said, I'm not sure if you've heard this. It said, there's nothing wrong with Mondays. You just hate your job.
Well, yeah, and I mean, but I think, you know, it's bigger than that. It's like even when we tell people, which is correct, which is, you know, you have to fit into the system. You have to play within Money, Inc.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that all of us need to do. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, really, the whole working for Money, Inc. is not working for the human race. That's what we're not questioning. Okay, I could have a job that I like, and I do have a job that I like, and I'm successful at it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what brings me happiness. At the same time, I'm still dedicating 5 days of my week, you know, solely to Money, Inc.
Oh yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And you know, when are we going to change the system really to start thinking about what is our goal as a human race? We bring up all this technology. Shouldn't it be freeing up our time to be more human with each other? And all this stuff, like, I think also just to go on another thing about, like, the superpowers, when we use these things, like the people that control the world and all this.
Right.
I think even that language is incorrect for us to continue using, because when we say that, we're taking away the power from the people. It's the people that have the power all through history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you talk about, the 1% of people have this much of the riches. Well, they should be scared, because if they're only the 1% and the 99% have billions more people, then it's quite easy to overrun the 1%.
Yeah. You know? I wrote a slam poem, and I haven't brought it out to the public yet, but I really like it. It's called The 99%. And I wrote it during the time when there was the whole Occupy Wall Street movement. And I thought to myself, you know, it's interesting that why are the 99% so angry at the 1%? On some level, you can almost make the argument that the 99% are the ones who, in fact, have the better lives, because we don't wake up in the morning and then leave our family behind and then not connect with them and not talk to our friends because we're so consumed with making money. We're actually the ones who see our families. We sit down with them and we talk to them. And of course, I mean, there's an epidemic going on there too. That's not happening as much as it should. But I get your point. The point is that the 1% out there, we think that they are the superpower. But when really and truly, since the history of time, it's always been the 99% that are the superpowers. You know, it's when you were talking about the system, I was thinking about a conversation I had with my friend Annie Lala, who ironically, as you probably know, was one of my podcast guests. And we were just having a catch up this week a couple of days ago, and I said to her, "Oh, Annie, you know, they have a place where they live in Miami, and I was talking to her about, you know, what happens when your daughter turns 5, and you know, what school do you think you're going to put her into?" And it's funny, I should have caught myself even saying this to someone like Annie. I've known her long enough, and she came back and she looked at me and she's like, "Oh, Stuart, come on, we're not going to send our kid to school."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, right. And she said, so we started talking about schooling, and she said to me, obviously the first thing was homeschooling as being option number one, but then option number two, which was one I hadn't quite heard of before, and I'm trying to remember, I think it's called unschooling, or the no schooling or something like that. Or no, I think maybe it's called no schooling. And what that is that basically, if you have the financial resources — I get that not everyone can do this — but if you have the financial resources or the time, you basically follow your child around. You let them walk out the door, and let's say you take them to the forest, and let's say they start getting really interested in insects. And every time you go to the forest, you notice they're always interested in insects. Well, then, you know what? Maybe we should really promote that and let them kind of go deeper into that and talking about insects. Let's get them to go to meet somebody who is a specialist in that, an expert in that. So that was – and what they said was that they've done studies of kids who have kind of gone through this type of schooling, and by the time they hit the age of 18, 19, when they – go to university and they take their SAT scores or whatever it may be, that they're quite often, on average, scoring much higher than the people who went through a traditional schooling format. And I mean, we see this time and time again. I mean, I think I may have said this to you when I last saw you and when you were visiting, but I love this sign that I saw recently. It said, another day has gone by, and once again, I didn't use algebra. You know, and it's like, we do go into the school system and we do allow ourselves to get so consumed with learning stuff that is just basically brain drain, and we're wasting the brain when it could be used to go into a sense of wonder or to learn things that we're really interested about.
Well, I mean, we've, again, just, it's amazing. And again, it goes back to the same thing that, I've come to the realization. I mean, I'm hitting 40 and, well, 38 now, going to hit 40 soon. And, you know, I just started to realize I'm just starting to learn now. I mean, last night I'm watching National Geographic about lions and seeing how they communicate. And it dawns on me to say, wait a second, how come I believe that communication is only coming from sound?
Right.
Like they were organizing themselves to hunt. The mother was telling the cubs that, you know, there's danger coming and all this. It wasn't like a noise or anything like that. So why have I grown up assuming that all communication comes from sound? It doesn't come from another energy or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, it's just amazing that we have grown up, I believe, to. And actually, I woke up one night 2 years ago and I wrote this down, and it goes to the kind of same concept. Like, we're always looking for answers. And the problem with always looking for answers is once someone gives you one, or once you get one or come to a conclusion that you believe, you close that subject and say, that's the way it is.
Right.
And that is just completely wrong.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, and when you go to look at things that are like science, which is constantly proving itself wrong, that's obviously the best system.
Yeah,
because, you know, you should never accept an answer because we just don't know.
Yeah.
So we should be questioning everything. And school does not, you know, I never went to school. I mean, I went until high school and just scraped through and barely got out, you know. But I never got it because I was like, you know, I had my own ideas. And, and the teacher was like, no, like, this is the way you need to do it. I was like, well, why? Like, yeah. I took a small business course, like entrepreneur course, and they were like, this is the way to do it. It's like, oh, how can you say this is the way to do it when entrepreneurs are the ones coming up with new ideas and new ways of doing things?
That's
like,
right.
Who wrote this textbook? Is this guy like multi-billionaire? Is he happy with his life? Like, who am I listening to? Who wrote the textbook?
Yeah,
you know? And you get in trouble for asking those questions. Like, I was the rebel.
Yeah.
Like, oh, like, Phil, be quiet. You know, we're trying to get through this lesson, like, you know.
I know. Same thing used to happen to me. I used to constantly find myself in situations where whether I would question a teacher, or whether I'd question a parent, or whether, you know, in my adult life, I've questioned police officers. And I've questioned these individuals in the most polite, professional, authentic way that I can possibly think of. And it doesn't matter. I mean, I could present my question to them on a platter of gold and flowers and incense, and they'd still be coming back with venom because it's just the act of questioning, which is wrong. And we see this, we see this playing out in every aspect of our lives. I mean, look at even relationships, right? Where people get married, or they have a baby together, or they move in together, whatever, and they automatically assume, well, you know what, I've kind of in line with what you're saying, with I've got the answer, I've met the partner, we did the courtship, we now got married, we now have children, I'm done, I've done it. And it's like, no, it's like your relationship is no different than a scientific experiment. And really and truly what you've done is, like a scientific experiment, you've taken two, whatever you want, amoebas or proteins or cells, you've put them together into a closed environment. Sometimes it's a petri dish, and sometimes it's a house in the suburbs. And in that petri dish or the house in the suburbs, we're going to see how those two things interact under different temperatures, under different circumstances. And you have to continuously come back to your relationship and say to ourselves, all right, you know, who are we when we have kids? Who are we when one of us is out of a job? Who are we when it's really hot out? Who are we when we're on this kind of vacation? And you're constantly supposed to be looking at ways to grow and to become better, and to see if there are maybe better ways to communicate. Maybe there are better ways to say sorry. Maybe there are better ways to have sex, whatever it happens to be. And to not just accept that, oh, this is the way it is, we're done. Because then, well, then of course you stop growing. And that's really, I guess that comes back to what I think that is my biggest frustration in life, is that we live in a world where there's so much room for growth, and we've created a system that doesn't allow us to grow.
Well, I mean, and that's exactly it. I mean, when you talk about relationships, what we're all doing is we're just thrown into it and being told, you know, by the TV, maybe by books you read, by the relationships that are around you and what they portray. But shouldn't we be taught about relationships in school from the beginning? I mean, not only just relationships as far as romantic relationships, but the relationships with the people that you have in your life.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, one of the things, you know, where when I first met you, you know, was a great breakthrough for me because I grew up in Toronto, in an area that, you know, there was lots of bad things going on and things like that. And I got into that and, you know, street cred and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't happy. I was very angry, whatnot. So I went off and I traveled to Europe for a year. So I left high school, worked for a year, saved the money, went off for a year. When I got there, I realized that I was a completely different person there because people perceived me not based on my reputation that I had at home, but as the person that I was now.
Right.
And when I went back to Toronto, I saw your play about being a friendship whore.
Right. Yeah.
You know, where you know, you keep the same friends around, you should mix that up and you should be talking to different people and mm-hmm. and things like that. I mean, these are important things that I think should be taught at the school level about relationships, about you know, how you deal with other people.
Right.
You know, this is what we should be learning in school. And we should, you know, we should be learning that. We should be learning finance, like how to pay the rent, like what you're gonna do, like how that's gonna work out. And it just, you know, how can you expect anyone to be great at relationships when really it's just something you're thrown into? Two people that know nothing have to figure it out.
Well, I mean, think about your sex life, right? And we won't get too deep into that right now, only because I know you have a job and we don't want you to lose it. But, you know, for most people, our parents don't teach us really anything above and beyond, hey, you should wear a condom. Mm. And then, you know, as a man, you and I had, I would imagine, a very similar experience. You get to a certain age, you have your first girlfriend who you have sex with. And, you know, of course, as a young guy, it's just like, just do it as fast as you can. And it lasts all 3 or 4 seconds. And then eventually, you know, you start getting older and maybe you start picking up on certain things that some of your guy friends say that make you think, oh, really? I've never tried that. And, you know, this is the way we're being exposed to things that we could do to create a better physical reaction or physical interaction with, you know, in our case, women, but with a partner. And then if you maybe think about it, like, let's be honest. Hey, as men, we're introduced to pornography, and then we mm-hmm. start getting other ideas. Oh, there's a position I've never thought of, or there's a, you know, and then, of course, many men start getting the wrong idea of what sex is about when they start using pornography as an example. And my point is that we really get to a point where today, most men in their 30s and 40s, and I would say women as well, but I'm speaking as a man, we have sex, and it's fun, and of course, physically, it feels good, but when it comes right down to it, I would imagine that we are just scratching the surface of the physical interaction that we could have with our partners, and that is because we've never been taught. And, I mean, my goodness, I remember when I was in high school, I was probably 14, 15 years old, and my sex education – I'll never forget this. My sex education teacher said, if you get something on – as he said, if you get something on your dick that you don't know what it is, pull it out and whack it across the desk. That's what he said. That was my introduction to STDs. And I'm thinking, I have no idea what he's talking about, but all of us just laughed. That was really funny. And okay, I guess I have no idea what herpes is. I have no idea what syphilis is. I have no idea what gonorrhea is. All right, move forward. And so if you think about it, you know, there's so many components to life that we're just never being taught. And, you know, back to the communication piece, I remember when I first started doing my corporate speeches and when I started being told by my friends, you should really write a book on this thing called Powerful Conversation, because I was doing these seminars at the time. And I was really reluctant. And the reason I was reluctant, I thought to myself, was I don't need to do a book on a subject that everybody already knows. I felt embarrassed. I mean, come on. Why am I writing a book? That's silly. Everyone knows how to have powerful conversation. And it wasn't until I started doing the actual workshops that I started noticing people coming up to me saying, wow, I've never thought to ask those kinds of questions, or I've never thought to be engaged that way, or I never knew what could come out of a relationship when you're actually fascinated by somebody. And I thought, wow, I didn't realize there was such a need, and it just woke me up to the fact that, yeah, parents and teachers and priests and uncles and aunts, whoever, people in the community, they don't teach this stuff. And we're all growing up essentially idiots.
Well, and I think Stuart, like, again, I think for me, because I'm always, you know, there's so many things going wrong in the world, and there's so many little, there's so many things, and there must be some root, like, cause to that. And what keeps bringing me back every time, like, you're talking about this, about, you know, what we know about sex, what we know about relationships, and again, it comes back to the wonder of things and asking, you know, the questions, but actually really questioning everything.
Yeah.
Because, again, it just comes back. We're told that this is the way to say it. So if we look at porn and say, okay, that's it, like, drill her for an hour, yeah, right? And, you know, and this and that, and that's the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
But even if we see that, why do we accept that? Because we've somehow, since children, have just been accustomed to accepting an answer, mm-hmm, and then moving that on and focusing, just like, don't ask the questions, just focus on what you know. Instead of actually waking up every day and being interested, really, right, legitimately. And I've heard that before, like, oh, every day is a chance to learn something new. But I didn't really get to that point until my age now, where every day now I wake up and I'm like, I'm learning something new. I'm wondering about things. I'm questioning, and I feel alive.
Yeah, I know.
You know? And I realize I've just been in this box, mm-hmm, you know, and I was going to say before, like, I woke up a couple of years ago, and it's just amazing how these things come, but I woke up with, like, kind of my own kind of quote, because I love reading quotes from other people and, like, things that just come across the truth. And I woke up and I wrote down my own, and it went like, most people spend their life looking for the answer, whereas I found life in the questions.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. That is so true.
Because that's where life is. It's about not knowing, but we've been kind of, you know, this is the way it is. So, and our environment structures that, because if you think about it, where most wonder comes, going back to the start of the conversation, when you look out into space or you look at space, like, wow, like, there's just no answer to that.
Right.
You know, it just leaves you like, it just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And what our society has done is that we no longer look up, because you can't see the stars because of all the lights in the city,
right,
where most of the populations live.
Sure.
Most people are stuck looking down at their cell phone. They don't look up,
mm-hmm,
you know? And so our big buildings in the cities, they block out our ability to see nature. We cut down all the trees. We don't see as many birds anymore. We're not, you know, I live here in Brazil. I have a backyard here. I got lots of different types of birds, things I've never seen in the UK or lived in Canada. And it amazes me. And I watch them and I'm just like, wow, like, look at this insect. Look at the colors. Like, look how it's adapted. And I just, you know, I go look it up on the internet and I learn about it. And I'm amazed.
Well, it's,
you know,
funny. I've always said, you know, and it's a little bit of a joke that I say to my friends when I see their kids, and, you know, especially little, usually around the age of between 1 and 2. And I love that age, because a child will see an insect, or a child will see rain for the very first time, and they start putting their hand in it or their hand in a puddle. And if you watch a child do that, I always say that these kids are on LSD. You know, because they're looking at it, and then they look at their hand the way that somebody who is on LSD would, and then they look at the sky, and then they look at they hear the breeze. Oh, what is that? That's the, what is that wind going through the leaves of tree? Oh my God, what is that? And these little kids are on the drug of life. And what ends up happening, and a lot of people pontificate this, they say that when a child is born, that a child knows everything it needs to know, and that what we've done is, as a society, we've made the mistake of believing that the point of life is to learn everything that it doesn't, that a human doesn't know, and then to die with knowing as much as you could. Whereas it's the exact opposite. A lot of spiritual people will say, they'll say that we as human beings are actually born with everything that we do know, which is the reason why children, you know, are so interested in different things, because they know it's important. They know that that's awesome, and that life is amazing. And that, in fact, what we end up doing is, instead of learning new information, we go through our lives and we have a process of forgetting. And, mm-hmm, and each year we forget more and more. There was a time that we used to know that trees were really interesting, but then we forgot that. There was a time that we used to know that a stranger in the sandbox or sitting next to us could be just the most incredible gift that you could open, and that was the reason we crawled over and started touching their face, and we forgot that. And so what happens, I think, is that the people who go on these spiritual quests, in fact, are not looking to learn something. They're looking to remember something. And that is something that is the big difference between, I think, people who become spiritual and who do get in tune with their greater self and those who don't. But and I mean, I think that you're a good example of all this, right? I mean, you with the questions that you've asked yourself, one big question you've asked yourself is you know, what is a job or where should one work? Most of us, we grow up in our case, you and I, in Toronto or surrounding area, and we just automatically assume that, well, of course, I'll stay in Toronto. My family's here. I'll have a job. But, you know, you left, for those who are listening right now, they don't know this, but you left Toronto, and then you went and you had a job in London, England, and then you worked there for a few years, and then you went now you live in Sao Paulo in Brazil. And you know, what has that been like for you as far as, you know, kind of going down, as they say, the road less traveled, or choosing the untraditional path with respect to your career?
Yeah, I think, you know, the funny thing is people always ask me that, especially meet people, you know, people from home or people that I meet here come just to visit from other countries. Like, how did you end up in Brazil, or why did you do that? And, you know, it's always interesting because you got the one side of you that falls into this, I guess, maybe on the ego to say, oh, yeah, you know, and they say, wow, it took risk doing the things you've done in your life. And, you know, I've said this to you before that, you know, I find it amazing that for me, it was never a risk. You know, it was just my intuition. You know, I always just went with what it felt. I was working with the company I still work with today. I went off to the UK, noticed they didn't do what we did, and I felt, well, why don't I just open the company there? Mm-hmm. And I didn't think about, what if I failed? What if this happens? What if that happens? It just felt right, so I did it, you know? And then business went well in England. I came to Brazil on a holiday, and man, I mean, you're talking about São Paulo, a dirty, ugly, violent city, you know, on the face of it, you know? It's just not a place most people would pick to live, you know?
Right.
But once you get into it and you meet the people and you see what's inside, I fell in love with it.
Right.
And so I left everything that I had, very successful in UK, what everybody would want, and I came to Brazil, but it wasn't a risk. It wasn't a decision. It was just my instinct said, that's where I need to be.
Right.
Rest unravel.
And so many people would say, like, for example, you know, for those listening, I think it's and fantastic that you also learned how to speak Portuguese. And I've been in Brazil with you, and I've seen you fluently speaking Portuguese, even though I recognize that even though I don't understand what you're saying, of course you're making mistakes, and I know you must have a thick accent, but it doesn't matter. You talk to people and you're communicating with people, and that's really all that matters. And so people would think, oh my God, I could never go to a new country. I could never learn a new language, and I could never, you know, have to create all these new friendships and then find a relationship. And you've managed to do all these great things. But yet, I think it is interesting that you never thought it was a big deal.
No, and I mean, you know, part of that comes from, I think I mentioned this to you before as well, that I still remember I was about 16. I was frustrated. You know, I wanted to do more with my life. I was being told by the teachers that I was stupid. I'd go nowhere. And, I was kind of a rebel. I wanted to prove them wrong. Mm-hmm. And I came across this interview I was on actually the Women's Television Network. I don't know if it's still there, you know, but so flipping
that,
through. Yeah. So they were doing women entrepreneurs. And so there was this woman. She was being interviewed by a young girl on that channel. And I never forget it. Stuck with me my whole life. And she said, so what's your story? So this woman had opened up a business, was massively successful. But what had happened was she had been divorced from her husband. It was quite a surprise to her. She had two kids. He left. She was stuck with the two kids. She had given up all her career to be, you know, the home mom and, you know, doing that kind of brilliant work, and now had to provide for the family. So she started this business, became hugely successful. And the interviewer said, you know, I just can't believe it. Like, you know, and the woman said, what? She's like, well, you know, you had two kids, whatever, you know, it was such a huge risk to do that. What if you failed? And she said, well, I've never seen the risk, you know, because I always knew I wouldn't fail. You know, I knew I would have failures along the way, and I knew there would be challenges, but it was always going to happen in my mind. So it was never a risk.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's a lot of it. It's that perception, you know?
Well, I think a lot of this is rooted, a lot of the people won't take risk and they won't take a leap, or they won't, whatever, anything like that, because they are attached to the outcome, okay? And so the idea is that this comes back once again to the system that we've bought into, which is The belief for most people is I'm supposed to live until at least the age of 80 or 90. And when I get to that age, I'm supposed to have a certain amount of money, a certain type of house, a certain type of retirement savings plan, all that kind of stuff, right? And so if you buy into that, then making certain decisions today does look like a risk, because something you could do today could jeopardize you getting that. But the truth is that if you don't buy into the end result, then you actually, what you've done is you've eliminated the risk of today, because it doesn't really, it's not a risk. All you're doing is just living. And my big belief about risk anyway has always been, because obviously I've taken a lot of risks to get to where I am, or risks at least based on what the people perceive as being risks. And, right. You know, and people have said the same thing to me. I can't believe it. You graduated from the School of Business and Economics, and you decided to write musicals? Who the hell? What, you're crazy. And as you remember, I used to produce these musicals in my in my loft where I lived, and and everyone literally, I mean, most people would think that I literally should be checked into a mental institution. And in my mind, I just felt, no, this is not risk at all. This is just fun. This is, you know, I'm figuring out ways to, you know, to make just enough money at that time. And in many cases, I was going a little bit in debt. A lot in debt at that time. And, but I knew that eventually the ideas that I was putting out there were going to take the debt away, that things would eventually turn around. And you look at it and you think to yourself, at the end of the day, even if, let's say, this musical doesn't take off, or this corporate speech or this new book or whatever, even if it doesn't take off, it doesn't really matter. That's actually not even the point. And this kind of really is laced with that popular quotation of, it's not the destination, it's the journey. But it's true, man. It's like, if you're in Brazil now, and if all of a sudden, let's say tomorrow your company decides to close down. Okay, so what do you do? Maybe you come back to Toronto, maybe you go to some new country. Well, you're going to get a job again. You got the personality, you've got the resume. So really, what is the big deal? What is the big risk? The most important thing is just doing the thing. And when you do the thing, whatever it happens to be for you, if it's moving to a new country or starting a business, or, you know, taking a risk and getting into a relationship with somebody that your family doesn't think you should be with, whatever it is, just realize that just the act of doing it is going to put you into a position where you're going to feel more alive than you will if you don't do it. And that is the point of life, not whether or not the thing you're going to do is going to affect some future result. The only question you have to ask yourself is this decision going to make me feel more alive today? And if the answer is yes, then you got to do it.
Well, I look at the language that we use a lot. Like, that's the point in life. Like, for me, there is no point in life.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's just, I'm living. That's it. Yeah. Right. Why does there have to be a point to my life? Like, of course, you know, I strive to be a great person, you know, you have your own ideas of what success are. But again, it goes back to having that answer. Like, do I need to have an answer? No. Do I need to think about what happens if I have to leave Brazil? No. When that happens, if that happens, then I will deal with it at that time, you know, but you know, when people talk about like, what have I accomplished and things like that, I'm embarrassed to talk to them about things about business, because that's just not what I think my accomplishments have been.
Right.
And I feel fake when I tell people about that. Oh, you know, I opened up this company. I do this. This is my title. I feel embarrassed talking in that way, because, you know, the value that I've got from my job has been the ability to live in different countries and meet different people. It's the relationships that I've created with different people and traveled with and spent time with. I mean, that is something, you know, it's just priceless.
Right. That's a true accomplishment.
And that can't be taken away from me. I mean, I could make $1 million and make a bad investment and that goes away. Mm-hmm. You know, money just comes and goes. But, you know, what I'm most careful of spending in my life is my time and who I spend that with.
Right.
You know, the time is really my currency. Yeah. Of, you know, making sure, like what you said back in your musical before, like with a group of friends you have, like who am I going to spend my time with? You know, because I've only got so much of it. I don't even know how much I have.
Right.
I can't go look into a bank account and say, how much time do I have there? I don't know.
Yeah.
And you have to come to terms with that. And I am, you know, I'm extremely grateful for the life I have because of the friends I've made and the relationships I have with people. And my whole work career and everything it, you know, has gone really well, but I think it's because my priorities have always been in that. It's always been in my relationships with people, you know, the joy of giving to others, you know, and just the joy of life every day to not just take it for granted, yeah. you know, and just, you know, make sh- and just understand how much time is really important. It's nothing to fear.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing you're sure of life, the only answer that there is in life is that you will die.
Yes.
I mean, that is the only definitive thing. The rest is all fictitious. We overthink things. Oh, it should be this. We judge it. It doesn't matter.
Right.
I mean, it just doesn't. Yeah. Like, whatever happens to me, to be honest, it just doesn't matter. I don't plan for the future anymore. I don't concern myself over things. I don't let my mind take away. I shut my mind off
yeah.
until I need to use it. And I'm not a perfectionist at that. It's a you know, everyone struggles with that every day. But
right.
you know, I've just come to this realization at this age that, you know, all that work and all this so-called success has never really meant that much. What means everything to me is the experience I have with people.
Well,
you know,
funny. Like I get a lot of people who say to me, because in my industry, as you know, as the professional speakers, you know, if you're good at what you do and if you're popular at what you do, that it is a lucrative industry. There's no big secret behind that.
Sure.
And people say to me, God, you know, like if you just did this and if you just did that, if you worked a bit harder, you could be in a situation where you could make, you know, $2 million a year, you know, and I'm like, yeah, it's pretty easy math to do. And if I did do that, I would make $2 million a year. But guess what? I'd be on the road in planes every single week, and I'm already in enough planes as it is, and I love my job. But I would be in probably hotels. We'll put it this way: I'd be on the road at least, I'd probably 200 out of 365 days out of the year.
Yeah.
And I love seeing, you know, the people that I love, and I love seeing the people in my personal life, and I love watching a good documentary, and I love going down to the bar and having a couple of beers and some chicken wings, you know, like these things feel good to me. And I don't want, if making $2 million a year is going to cause me to miss that, well, then I'm happy with a lot less money, and it's still more than enough that anyone would ever need. And to be able to do the things that are most important, and that, I think that's one of the things that we often miss is, you know, just that, like you said, those real strong, powerful human relationships.
No, it's everything, and that's, you know, that's what life is. I mean, you know, it's breaking down all those barriers that we all grow up with, and we try to, you know, stay as individuals, and I'm this individual, and, you know, and it's not about being an individual. It's about being with other humans and sharing experiences, you know? I mean, that's everything. That's your life.
Yeah.
I mean, you only have one.
Yeah, and I always say, sorry to interrupt you, I always say that to not just wait for it to happen, but to actively make it happen, to actively, you know, invite your friends over for a barbecue, to actively, which by the way is a just a side note, I find it so amazing how many people don't initiate group gatherings. Like there's always that one or two people in like every social circle who are always the ones that get everyone together, and then everyone else just like lemmings, they just show up and they just kind of consume as opposed to creating. But you know, to actively initiate people getting together for a barbecue, to actively initiate you know, let's say joining some sort of book club or whatever, get yourself out there and tap into one of the greatest things you'll ever tap into, and as we say, that is people. I'm curious, in Brazil, what do they do differently there? Like, I mean, I've only been in Brazil for a few days that one time when I saw you, which was obviously World Cup, yeah! what do they do? What's different about the way that human beings interact with each other compared to, like, us Westerners?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the phenomenal thing. I mean, obviously, when you go on vacation, you get to experience a bit of it. But when you live somewhere, you really see people, I mean, it's like a different planet. I mean, the cultures are completely different. So, I mean, some of the most positive things here are how close people are. So, you know, as Canadians and you know, North America and even in England, you know, a lot of it is the handshake when you meet somebody,
right.
You know. And here, it's a hug.
If you meet somebody for the first time?
Well, for the first time, it may not be like the full hug. The full hug's more for your friends. It will be more of the kind of gangster hug, like, you know. But, you know, it would be a handshake, but it's also kind of a tap on the body as well.
Right.
So it's a little, hey, how's it going? And then you pat them on the shoulder or you pat them on the rib cage, you know. And they have more a more sense of closeness. Like, so for instance, you know, one of the ones examples I love to tell everybody is that when you're at a when you come into a bar and you've got a you come to meet a friend and he's, oh yeah, we're meeting at a bar with a bunch of other friends. When you show up, you have to go and physically shake the hand, kiss the girls of everyone at that table.
Right.
Right? That's the culture. And when you leave, you have to do the same thing. And I mean, it's a lot of work sometimes. You know? But they take the time here to do that. That's really important, the network here, you know, of, right. of how you treat other people. And it was, for me as a Canadian, it was very difficult because I didn't hug anyone before.
Right.
You know? And now all of a sudden, you know, I'm making friends and people see you, like you're walking down the street and it's like, oh, gringo, like foreigner, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you met this guy the other night. He comes over. He's like, gives you a big hug. Like, how'd you like last night? It's like, well, you're just kind of like, whoa. Like,
you know? I just met you recently.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, and you know, those are some of the big differences. And, you know, the dating scene here, I mean, you know, hooking up with people, there's no this big game and this kind of like I was used to in Toronto, which was and in London, you know, this kind of game. People here like get together very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Singles go out and they meet each other. They're kissing, you know, within an hour, within 5 minutes,
right.
You know, and, you know, so, you know, they're just I've always said, you know, the analogy I use, because, you know, I don't like to knock Canada. I think it's just, you know, it's a beautiful country and, you know, we have great people, a lot of multiculturalism. But the way that I see the difference between Canada and Brazil is the analogy of a house. So okay. Canada is like you walk into the house and everything's just perfectly clean. It's all in order. Mm-hmm. Everything works.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just like that's what you want in a house and that's what you think you want in a house.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to the, and again, an analogy at the House of Brazil, it's not like that. Things don't work, right?
Yeah.
Not everything's not perfect. There's a lot of stuff going wrong and whatever. But there's a real sense of love in the house. There's a real sense of community. And you go in there and it's like a comfortable couch that's old,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
It's not just a plain white couch that's all perfectly and you're afraid to put your cup on the table,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
You're made to feel, as soon as you walk into the house here, you're made to feel very comfortable. The environment is, with the people and everything, less sterile, less rules,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, those are some of the... You know, the kind of big cultural differences.
Well, you know, one of the things it makes me think of is that, and as you know, I've done a lot of travel in places that are not necessarily always the first places that people go to, or you know, at least I like to go off the beaten path.
Sure.
And so what I like about those types of travel experiences is that it's not comfortable. It's not perfect. You know, I get into a hotel and I jump in the shower and the water is cold. And, you know, I don't like that every night, but to have an experience like that, it makes you, first of all, of course, appreciate what you've got at home. But secondly, it just really does make you feel more alive. And I believe that we in the Western world, what we've done is with technology and with financial resources, we've essentially made a world that is, I mean, compared to most of the world, I'll use the word perfect. When I use the word perfect, I mean it easy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I can imagine that if somebody came from, you know, Sri Lanka into my apartment today and I took them out of their shantytown village, they'd be like, oh my God, so you just press that button and it makes it hotter or colder in here? Or
yeah.
I just walk over to that thing, I just pull that thing up and clean water comes out into a glass, I just put it right in my mouth, I just drink it, and on and on and on. And to me, as wonderful as it is, I get it. Like who doesn't enjoy air conditioning when it's 1,000 degrees out? But I don't like it for too long. I need to shake things up, and I think that that's probably one of the great things about living in a place like Sao Paulo. My guess would be is that, you know, it's not always predictable. It's not always easy every single day, and that kind of forces you to be. To be awake and to be alive. You know, I was talking about these pictures with what's it called? There used to be this pictures of the week, right?
Right.
And in these pictures of the week, there were pictures from all around the world. I can't remember what it was called, but anyway, they're all around the world, and you can still see it. Oh, MSNBC, and they're pictures from photojournalists, and. In these pictures, it's always like, quite often they're horrific pictures, like here's the aftermath of a bomb being exploded in Pakistan, or here is a picture of, in some cases, something really beautiful, someone's diving off some waterfall. And it started dawning on me, it started dawning on us that we're like, these pictures, they never, there's never any pictures from Canada.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Or really, or the United States in many cases. There were always pictures of places like Sao Paulo or places like India. And it's like, right, nothing is really, everything is great here and everyone wants to come here. But just so they know, nothing's really happening at the same level that it's happening in other places. Because in other places, you know, it's still sweaty and dirty and ugly and chaotic.
Well, and I guess it all, again, goes back to the same point. When you're living, and my experience living in different countries, even the UK, it, you know, it forces you into back into that child mode of wondering, like, wow, how does that work? You know, and now when you add Brazil in with a different language, now you've got a whole new challenge. Now you're back to the child thing where it's like, I don't understand what this person's saying, but I have to figure it out. I have to be able to communicate. So you learn over time, you go through that whole processing, just like a child of learning something new, you know? And it's not, again, not something I questioned, like, oh, I'm not going to be able to do it. I just knew over time, I'm gonna have to learn. Of course, took lessons or whatever, but you know, you're just like a child. You just learn as you go along, and you don't need to put the pressure on yourself. And it forces you back into the wonder of like, wow, I didn't know things could be that way. I didn't know a dating scene could be like that. I didn't know that you could be always, you know, when you meet your friends, hugging them and showing that kind of emotion.
Right.
You know, my culture told me that that was not normal.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm here, and it's not normal to be what I used to think was normal. So again, it opens up all those questions. Okay, well, what is normal? Is there normal? You know, like, why am I trying to fit into something? And so when you're in a different country, whether you're traveling or whether you're living there, I think it again goes back to, it allows you to ask those questions that you question what you used to think, you know?
Yeah.
What I see, like, what Toronto misses and all that. But when I come back to Toronto, the same city that I grew up in, after living here for now 6 years, I see Toronto completely differently. And I value things that I never valued before. You know, I value the things that I have here, and I love the lifestyle, whatever, but there's bad things with the violence and things like that here that Toronto doesn't really have at that scale.
Right.
And so it's amazing how the same city that I have grew up in most of my life, now I see it completely different. Yet it's the same place.
Yes, yes. And isn't that what it's all about, right? Like how the same thing, like back to what you were saying earlier on, and I think this is probably almost a great note for us to end off on, and that's the idea that when a child enters the living room of their house, it can become a different place every single time they go into it. One day it's a place where they want to turn it into a Lego land. And then the next day it's a place where they turn it into a castle, when they turn it into a fort. And the next day they go in there and they turn it into a little Olympic ring where they're having races with each other. And they've, what they're doing is they're seeing the same place differently every time they enter it. And it's because they're allowing themselves to have that wonder. And whereas I think it's, you know, so interesting that how we all wake up every single day in this unbelievable place called planet Earth, and we don't look around it and go, holy shit.
Exactly.
I mean, look at those insects. Look at those flowers. Look at the way those people are interacting. Look at the way that even my boss is acting in this particular meeting. There's a whole psychological kind of circus happening in this meeting room, and I get to be able to watch it. I shouldn't be bored. I shouldn't be upset. I shouldn't be sitting here going, oh, this is frustrating. What a boring meeting. If I know how to look at it with wonder and with questions and with the possibilities, I can actually see a psychological, you know, fantasy land all playing out in front of me.
Exactly that.
Yeah.
I mean, the kids are happy. Why do we assume that the adults got it right? Maybe they have it right. I mean, again, it's just asking that question. They're happy. Most adults aren't.
Yeah, that's a good point, right? I love it. But you know what? Let's end it off there, because that's a great way to leave it off. It's like, all right, for all those of you who are listening right now, just heads up, you're not happy. But you can be if you start acting like a child again. But
yeah.
This is the ultimate thing that I hope people take away from this conversation, is that in life, it's really, it is what we make it. And we are the ones that choose the questions that we ask ourselves. We're the ones who choose the conversations that we have in our head, the conversations we have with other people, and the types of situations we put ourselves in to really question what is normal and to really kind of question what it is that we're supposed to be buying into and what kind of level of joy we can really bring ourselves in lives based on those kinds of questions. So, Phil, man, I love speaking to you, brother. It's always a great conversation, and I love the way that you see life, and I love that it's no bullshit with you. So thanks for taking the time from, I guess this is what happens when you're a big shot down there in Brazil. You can just kind of take an hour out of your day on Friday and talk to me.
Well, you got to spend your time the way you want to spend it, right? So this is a well-spent hour for me, and, congratulations on everything you do. I think it's, for the amount of people that listen to these podcasts, it's always a great medium to go back to that radio style and learn something new, and just proud that and honored that you asked me to have the conversation and have it recorded.
Well, brother, I can tell you there's going to be a lot of people who will I think will be very happy that I asked you to be on this show. So thanks for taking the time. You and I will have a separate catch-up soon, but get back to work. I think I probably should do the same thing, and I'll speak to you really soon.
All right. Peace.
Okay. Thanks, Phil.
The number you have dialed has been changed.
Thank you for tuning in to The Stuart Knight Show. We hope you've enjoyed this powerful conversation. People are fascinating, and so are you. And the right questions will prove it.